Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Adam Koch is my name. Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune are my co-hosts. Gents, wonderful to see you both again.
Be with you.
Yeah, likewise.
Well, 3 years on from Russia invading Ukraine, and this week could prove to be a defining one for what is happening in the war. Multiple talks underway, particularly led by players that, well, to be honest, has been surprising for most of the world. Rodney, what has prompted this round of talks on how to deal with the Ukraine situation 3 years on?
Well, Donald Trump and his call to Vladimir Putin has prompted this particular set of talks. In terms of the host and mediator, the fact that Qatar has presented itself as a mediator in disputes, and particularly around Gaza and so on, I think the Saudis see that as a mechanism to elevate their own global profile as a player in the world stage, and the biggest economy and political block within the Middle East. So it's attractive from the Saudi perspective. It's catalyzed by the Trump and Putin call. And of course, it excludes Europe, excludes Zelensky, not quite sure what the areas of discussion are going to be. But presumably, from Russia's perspective, it's to persuade the US to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine. And from the American perspective, it feels like they will trade anything for the war to stop so they can claim credit for it, though there's already been a knockback now for the US on a request to Ukraine about access to mineral rights upon any ceasefire cessation in terms of future security support. So that shows that Ukraine realizes what its potential trade is with the US and wants to extract better value for its own population, given the obvious sacrifice that they've made in recent years since the invasion. So optimistic that something will come of it. I'm sure they can find some middle ground, but the middle ground between America and Russia isn't necessarily a middle ground that Europe will be happy with, that Ukraine will be happy with, or that will be able to actually get enough support to have an impact. I don't know, Ozan. Maybe you think more optimistically on it.
No, not at all. I think we're in a very odd situation. Not to be unexpected. There's nothing surprising about where we are. I think Trump was very clear about what he wanted to do during the campaign. He was certainly saying that he wants to end the war quickly. Very much talking in favour of what would objectively be categorised as Russia's interests or in Russia's interests. I'm very surprised that the Europeans were somewhat kind of caught off guard with this. I think it's not surprising. That's not to say it's not really, really concerning, because I think any peace deal without Ukraine in the room cannot be something that Ukraine is going to agree to, particularly considering that, as we discussed on last week's podcast, the people who are putting this together, I'm trying to be generous here, but are really incompetent. Like, we've got Hegseth, who, before he came in charge of the biggest army in the world, was a Fox News anchor on the weekends. In the spirit of giving everyone a fair go, people gave him a fair go, and he really proved that he is completely not up to the job. His press conference is probably one of the worst press conferences that I've seen on an international stage of any American politician, or any American administrator, and that's going back to the Bush years, where we had plenty of people to kind of point fingers to and say they're terrible international kind of operators. But look, at the end of the day, this was supposed to be a 3-day war. in 2022, February. It's been going on for 3 years. Russia is nowhere near achieving its objective. And, you know, there are some very obvious facts here. Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, but also previous in 2014. Russia is saying that it will not give up any of the land that it's taken. And that goes back to the 2014 maps of Ukraine pre that invasion. It will not agree to Ukraine joining NATO and has put a number of other conditions, including the Europeans not being present or being a part of the peace deal. So anything that comes out of Saudi Arabia, I suspect, won't be accepted by Ukraine. But again, this is classic Trump. He's going to get a win out of this because whatever happens, if, for example, he puts a deal on the table for Ukraine, Ukraine doesn't accept it, then he's got every right or every opportunity to go back home and say to his base, hey, I tried to end the war. You know, they're not coming on board. So we're going to effectively cut our aid and they're on their own, which then means one of two things. Russia takes over more land or Europe steps up and increases its defense expenditure, increases its defense presence in that region. Either way, Trump gets what he wants because at the end of the day, he's been you know, berating the Europeans in his first term even to increase their defense spending. And look, he might have a point on that, but there's a way to do that. And then there's a way not to do it, i.e. the way that J.D. Vance decided to lecture European countries on democracy and free speech. And again, it's the same thing, the same MAGA playbook. It's, you know, their accusations are effectively confessions. They basically are accusing everyone of everything that they're doing. So it's going to be a very messy time.
Well, just quickly on the MAGA playbook, didn't Trump say last week that if Hamas doesn't release all the Israeli hostages, all hell would break loose? I'm pretty sure that didn't happen, right? Neither of those two things happened. And this is the same situation here. I mean, you've got Ukraine saying any deal, the Ukrainian president said this, any deal that does not involve Ukraine is not one that we're going to agree to, that you cannot make a decision about us without us at the table, right? And this is, again, to your point, Ozan.
Fair enough.
Absolutely, right? And to your point, it is completely a political move. It's going to look like a Trump win. He's, you know, he's brought the Saudis to the table, for Christ's sake. I mean, that's a win in itself as far as he's concerned and his supporters and loyalists are concerned. This will seem like a Trump win on the domestic and international stage. However, on the ground, either not a lot will change for Ukraine or not a lot will change that will benefit the Ukrainians. And as far as all reporting is concerned, they are more concerned about their future than they ever have been before. These are complex international matters, way beyond the imagination and intelligence of the three of us on this podcast, let alone the people who are, you know, potentially even sitting down and having conversations about these. But the fact that you are not talking to the very people that this is going to affect and bringing them to the table, as much as Trump wants to say that, well, they will be included, just not in these Saudi talks. I mean, that is, it's beyond outrageous. It is just ridiculous at this point.
And look, 100%. And it's not unexpected, as I said before. And, you know, we, for the last 5 or 6 years, the Trump types, some of these MAGA conservatives have been building an alliance of autocrats around the world. Now, you know, it's take the Hungarian president, Viktor Orban. It's funny that the only country in Europe who supports Trump's strategy on this is Hungary. And therefore, a minister was running around yesterday saying that Europe doesn't deserve to be at the table, or Europe should have nothing to do with this, etc. This has all been a part of the game that the MAGA types have been playing for a very long time now, and they've been building a network of autocrats that effectively believe in the populist kind of politics that they believe in. And, you know, there's a lot of ideological kind of similarities between Trump and Viktor Orban and Putin. And now, I'm sorry to say, but Trump believes that he has the mandate to not only behave like an autocrat at home, but also behave like an autocrat in the international realm. And this is very, very dangerous. What it's done is it has made Europe more unified, which is not a bad thing. But it's also, I think, raising a lot of questions amongst many world leaders today around whether the US is actually a very good ally or can be a trusted and reliable ally. And this is not good for the US because it's only a matter of time until China starts to capitalize on this and starts to kind of pull a fair few people who might have looked to the West or to the US as allies or economic partners. You know, it's only a matter of time that China starts to pull these people in. And at the end of the day, it's very understandable if people are starting to question their relationship with the US.
I mean, Europe certainly. There was a very, I'm going to say, clever interview from Kaja Kallas, who's obviously the foreign, sits in the foreign affairs chair now for the EU, who I thought was very scathing in a polite way in how she responded to US officials making statements in around Ukraine after the NATO meeting. And it feels to me that Europe may well find itself, apart from Orban, on the same page in how they wish to respond to this, because unlike the US, the European Union do face a direct threat irrespective of the outcome of these negotiations. They are going to have to focus on defence irrespective of what Trump thinks they should spend on defence. And you know, the German election, once it's out of the way, Britain and France have already said they're prepared, as well as some of the Scandinavian and Baltic countries, to put troops into Ukraine in order to maintain security. So no doubt Germany has to navigate the election. But if Germany's on the same page as France, the UK, and the other stronger European economies, that's another outcome that I'm sure Russia probably wouldn't have wanted on the onset of this conflict. Where it leaves NATO might be slightly different, but I can't see that the likes of the non-European NATO countries would be sitting with America, and all America's doing, or the US is doing, is potentially isolating itself from all its allies in the medium to long term.
What about the UK, Rodney? Because Prime Minister Starmer came out with a bit of a statement, I guess, on this particular matter. I mean, we're talking, what, peacekeeping troops now sent from the UK to Ukraine? Is that a thing?
That's on the table in terms of the UK's position. But I'm sure that they're also, with European partners, looking to see how much longer they can fund Ukraine and continue to support Ukraine should the US walk away. And European defence industries have been moving to a forward-thinking position in the last few years because of events that have obviously taken place. And they may well not be ready at this stage, but they're moving towards a ready position. And those smaller countries in the Baltics and so on are, and of course Poland, are much closer to where the tension is, and have more than exceeded the 2.5% or whatever it is spending requirement for NATO. Those are the countries that are spending more, that are doing more, and it feels that they're not doing it in isolation, and they do have political support from larger European economies. And I talk about the UK as European economy that sits outside the EU, but in terms of these types of issues, are very much on the same page as their European Union partners. And to be honest, I don't think that Starmer's position will be anything other than popular in the UK.
Well, it's hard to believe that so much of the progress in this space, internationally as well as domestically in the US, has just taken place in just the 4 weeks that Donald Trump has been the new president of the United States, or rather the re-elected president of the United States, I should say. He's averaging about 3 executive orders a day. Elon Musk is, of course, in charge of the the Department of Government Efficiency, and we saw that press conference with him and his son X and Donald Trump in the Oval Office, which was, I guess, bizarre in so many ways. Elon wearing a Make America Great Again black hat and, you know, donning a T-shirt and a big sort of trench coat. But one really interesting thing happened, and that was, let me ask you to explain this, Ozan, but imagine if you're a federal government employee, you receive an email on Thursday saying your job has been terminated and now the government wants you back. That's exactly what happened. To take us through that.
Well, yeah, and imagine that you're in charge of an area of policy that has catastrophic kind of possible outcomes if things go wrong. And my friend, you're talking about the employees of the Nuclear Safety Authority, who are effectively, put simply, in charge of ensuring nuclear safety across the country. And I suspect they play a pretty wider role, just even beyond the US. So, yes, they were sacked. And then in true Elon Musk and back then Twitter-style fashion, they were sacked. And then I think someone realized that these guys might be a little bit important. Let's get them back. However, of course, when they were sacked, they were cut their access to their emails and government-issued phones, etc., was cut off. So they had quite a bit of difficulty, I believe, over the weekend trying to get in contact with them to bring them back into roles that are very much important, I think, for the future of humanity. Look, I think it just goes to the broader topic here that I'm sure Elon Musk is a very smart businessman. He has to be. He's had some great successes with his companies, etc. But the sooner he comes to the realization that government is not Twitter, and you can't just go around gutting things and cutting things off and walking into government agencies and taking whatever you want. There are rules, there are laws, there are institutions that are in place to ensure that government runs well and that government runs effectively. And, you know, what concerns me is that there is no plan here. Basically, they said to the electorate, and the electorate supported this, that apparently the US government is a deep state, it's corrupt, it's a swamp, etc., and they want a mandate to just break it up and then fix it. But there is, you know, there's no plan, there is no strategy, there is no indication that they have any idea what to do once they break it and destroy it. So, you know, if I was an American, I would be very concerned about what's going on right now, because this is not a normal way a democracy should be running. This is not how you would expect a elected government to govern. And we've talked about this quite a bit. I think it's, Trump is very good at winning elections, but he's not very good at governing. He's shown us that last time in his first term. And he's even worse now, because he has a bunch of unelected, unaccountable people who are running around just causing mayhem, and for again, absolutely no reason. And what bothers me most about this, and what I think most people should find extremely concerning, is that, you know, take away the MAGA extremists, the people who will follow Trump wherever he goes, they're in it till the end. But there are a lot of intelligent people, and there are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, were very angry. And, you know, fine, they were angry. They gave Donald Trump a vote. They wanted to give him a chance to fix things. But surely they've got to come to the realization that this is not what they had in mind. I mean, this cannot be what they had in mind, because many, many people are not MAGA cultists. They are people who voted because they were angry. They might have been angry at, you know, too much wokeism, too much DEA, too much of trans people playing in sports, you know, all of this sort of stuff, and the price of eggs, all of these things, Soros, you know, they were all angry at these things. And what have we ended up with? We've ended up with the price of eggs going up. Inflation is continuing to go up. Of course, they'll blame Biden for this as well, as they do. But it's on them now. I mean, Trump is now president. And, you know, it was fair game before. The price of eggs were blamed on Biden. Now it's Trump's fault. And then, you know, we talk about a deep state and a Soros type of character, apparently behind the scenes, pulling all the strings. Now we have the world's richest man, not even behind the scenes, overtly going around trying to destroy the government. And that's all he's doing. And not only that, you know, if you had told me 10, 15 years ago that the world's richest man, who relies on billions of dollars every year from government contracts, is given the keys to the Treasury and is given the mandate to cut the budget, I would have said you're mad. And this is where I can't understand how people are not up in arms about this. Like, this is not even conflict of interest. This is how oligarchies are run. This is how autocracies are run. I mean, I would expect this sort of thing from Russia, not the United States. So I'm confused. I don't know what to say.
But what if some of these DOGE reforms work? I mean, that I may not believe that they will, but what if they do? You know, is it possible that there is a different way to do things? When we have the UK elections, the election's about improving public services. It's not in America. It's just about making it cheaper, cheaper food. You know, no one's saying better schools, better healthcare. They're saying cheaper government, smaller government. And if they are able to deliver a similar standard of government to what they have at a much more greatly reduced cost, well, they're going to peddle that as a huge success, and potentially it'll be something which other governments will seek to follow, to deliver the same at cheaper. And from America's point of view, you know, when you look at debt, when you look at other things that they want to do, simply cutting cost would be a huge success on this sort of uber capitalist type platform that they want to get to, and make the economy super attractive. You know, we don't talk about green energy and energy anymore. We just talk about energy cost. They've killed the sustainability thing. ESG's been killed largely, and the whole conversation's taking place in a different space. I completely agree that the risk and things like the NNSA, and although they reports that they don't quite understand the jobs that people are doing sometimes when they're asking them to take their final paycheck and go home for the afternoon, I think probably the clue in the name of the National Nuclear Security Administration would have been one that they should have been probably cognizant of. So they're taking high risk. They're trying to do things very quickly and very dramatically, but it is possible that they will shake up the government and still be able to deliver government, federal, and, you know, services to a standard that the public don't really recognize any difference. And if they do, they'll have had a success.
Look, it's very possible that they may succeed. I'm not saying that, but, you know, I would have thought that you would do things in a more systematic manner and firstly sit down and say, okay, let's bring in auditors. Let's bring in people who actually understand what the government does. I'm sorry to say Elon Musk has a lot of talents, but he's shown clear example evidence that he has no idea how government works. So, you know, this is not, in my opinion, the way to go about it. And nobody's saying, I would agree 100% that probably, you know, every government should go through a process of you know, going through each budget line item and figuring out whether we need to, or whether the government needs to spend that money, is it worthwhile, etc. But this is not the intention here. This is, I mean, the DOGE mob have basically gone through the budget and said the thing and singled out budget programs that they don't like and have labeled them fraud. I mean, they're not serious about this, Rodney. It's not a, you know, this is just a political game for them. They're trying to take control.
No, and there is a political element on, and I think you said, well, Gizem and so on, policy areas they don't like. They're just getting rid of the agency who either introduces or enforces those particular policies. And again, 100%, you're right that what they're doing is the wrong order, in that before you make a cut, you need to understand the impact, would be the conventional approach. Well, what they're doing is making the cut and then asking people to justify the reintroduction of what they were delivering, and by looking to see whether there's a gap, rather than assessing it and predicting it, they're actually nearly live testing the impact rather than risk assessing before they do it, and that will throw up lots of problems, right? I think we
Yeah,
can
but I mean,
agree on that. Where
I
services
think.
and funding are cut, they realize they've cut the wrong thing. They have to try and reintroduce it. But that's their, it's a corporate attitude to government. It's like
It's a
saying,
Silicon Valley attitude, yeah.
yeah, and yeah, maybe a Silicon Valley attitude's better. And it's like saying, well, look, how thin do we need to make this parachute before it doesn't hold the weight of an average human? And someone says, well, look, let's just test it on people until we get one that fails, and then we'll stop and go back to the iteration before that. So that, you know, don't spend time and money on the science. Let's just give it a go. It feels like that's the sort of attitude that they have. However, if it works, saves lots of money, has a few problems, but people forget about it quickly, I think other governments will try and do similar cost cutting as use it as a template. So what
You
I think is there'll be
know what's the
positives
problem?
within it, and they'll seize upon the positives to mask over the few dead sky jumpers whose parachutes weren't right or whatever it happened to be.
You know what the problem is? I think this is going to be the issue because nothing they do will ever be a failure, because they effectively control, despite the MAGA types talking about the fact that the mainstream controls the media, etc. No, I mean that they control the airways and. They have a propaganda machine that's unrivaled. There will be no failures in this. So what it sends, what it sends to the message that it sends to the rest of the world is this is the way to do it. Because I don't think that there's going. I mean, there is no objective way to look at this and figure out whether it's been successful or not. Because whatever problems there are will be hidden, or people will just. We'll continue to suspend reality when we're talking about these things, and focus on the one or two DEI programs that were cut, and then all of the other things that happen as a result of this will be the Democrats' fault or George Soros's fault or Biden's fault. We're not having an objective conversation. We're not dealing with facts or truths. So. There is no way to see whether this will succeed or fail. Of course, it's going to succeed because Trump will put forward the narrative and will spin the story that this is going to be a success. So, I think, to be honest with you, to be pessimistic, it's from a communications point of view, it's doomed for the Democrats and for those people who are concerned about what's going
On that cheery note.
on. On that cheery note, how much do we place blame in where on earth are the Democrats here? Because the silence is deafening. They are not out and about and criticizing and holding the government to account, which in any representative government or in any democracy, that is, of course, one of the main points that any opposition should be doing. We are not hearing much, if anything at all, from them, even when some outrageous things happen. I mean, this week, Elon Musk said something along the lines of we shouldn't be sending $50 million worth of condoms to the Gaza Strip for Hamas to use, which of course was not what was happening. The $50 million in condoms was part of the US Aid Department policy, which was sent to Gaza in Mozambique, which of course was there to sort of combat the deadly HIV virus. I mean, these are critical mistakes and critical statements to be making, things that you don't really want to be getting wrong. But back to my point of where's everyone else? Why are, I mean, to say that, Trump and the Republicans control the airwaves, why are the Democrats and his opponents letting this happen? Surely there has to be a degree of accountability there.
Well, where are the Democrats? That's a very good question, and one that needs to be asked. But where are all the other people who should know better? but who can't give up their anger towards, you know, the four trans people playing in professional sports, can't give up their anger at all the DEI programs that's angered them for the last 4 or 5 years, you know, can't give up their anger for the egg prices, for Soros's involvement in the deep state. You know, these people need to just put their anger aside and say, okay, we've got bigger issues here. We've the US government is being overtaken by a group of people who are not are saying, it's not like we're making this up. This is no longer something that, you know, people are being alarmist about. Trump is saying that you know, he who saves the country, you know, does not violate any laws. The vice president is saying that it's okay to not comply with certain legal judgments. So where are all these people? It's not just the Democrats. I think the Democrats are doing a very poor job. But where are all of the other people who may have been very angry at the Democrats and very angry at Biden and may have, you know, put a protest vote in place, but surely they cannot be okay with what's going on today?
Yeah, I just think they're disorganized. They don't know what to respond to, in the same way that they got a tsunami of media action during the campaign, that they, you know, flooding the field, that they just didn't know where to respond. It's the same now with announcements that are being made. They just need to select one or two, focus on them, and respond to them in an organized and systematic way. And at the minute, they're failing to do that. I don't know whether it's because they don't have people willing to put their heads up and respond. They don't have the right spokespersons in place, or they just don't have a central strategy to respond to these types of high-paced announcements. But I mean, responding to nothing is no excuse. If you're last in a race, you focus on passing the person just in front of you, not the leader, and they're not even doing that at this stage. It's a perhaps the New York thing with Eric Adams is part of the first steps of some coordinated effort by the Democrats. But even then, they're looking to use the governor to invoke some, I don't know, 200-year-old law that's probably never been used to remove him from office, instead of something that people can actually understand, rather than trying to win on the technicalities. It doesn't sound like they're offering a different approach to something Trump might do.
Look, it also, I think, has a lot to do with the system, the US system. It's quite different to you know, where we come from, where there's a shadow cabinet concept, which is effectively an opposition. They are in parliament. They have portfolio responsibilities, and their job is to hold the government of the day accountable. The US system doesn't have this sort of thing. I mean, if you don't have any power within the Congress, if you don't hold the Congress as a political party, or the Senate, or the presidency, you know, the system is such that you're in the political wilderness. So this is something that I think is a deficiency in the US system. It's very difficult, particularly in this media landscape, it's very difficult to have a coordinated kind of opposition. So, you know, that's one thing, but what they have to do to kind of, I suppose, make up for that is, or to compensate for it, is to have a bunch of people like Pete Buttigieg and others who are very, very good communicators, you know, out there every single day, almost like a presidential campaign, you know, holding press conferences, holding rallies and just doing things. And look, some of them are trying, I think, but because effectively Trump has monopolized the media attention with his 150 executive orders a day, like, it's impossible for these people to get any attention. And many of them don't have the profile either. So you need to really have a coordinated approach. And perhaps it's time for the Democratic National Committee to come in and start running some sort of campaign to push back on some of this stuff, because clearly it's not going to happen in Congress. Again, saying that, it may well be that, you know, we're in the first 100 days. Trump is in a honeymoon. He's not really had his legislative powers at this point in time in Congress or the Senate properly tested. There are a number of big tests coming up with the budget. He wants to increase the budget ceiling by $4 trillion. So there are a bunch of things that I suspect many in the Republican congressional caucus may not agree with, and you know, let's see what happens. That might give an opportunity for the Democrats to get themselves inserted into the narrative and into the story and put up a bit more fight. But yeah, they've got to start doing something, because as you said, Rodney, they're running last, and doesn't seem like they're running much.
Well, speaking of another race, all eyes will be on the German elections this weekend. That country heading to the polls. Rodney, give us the latest in terms of polls and what we're expecting to see in terms of outcomes.
So Merz is leading on 26%. Then it's the far right on 20%, and then the incumbent Olaf Scholz is trailing a rather dismal third on 16%. So we are going to see a change of government in Germany. I wonder, the issue now becomes, who's the coalition likely to be between? Because a real poor performance from the incumbent does open the potential for a centrist coalition. Should there be problems with any discussions between the centre right and the right, because the gap's so big that it would be a very clear senior and junior partner. Now, whether they would be prepared to serve in government again in those circumstances, I don't know. But often when people are offered a government position, they find it very difficult to turn it down, irrespective of whether their broader party thinks it's in the long-term interest. So I think it's all to play for. We are looking at a very clear result, how it translates in seats, and then the negotiations. We will see. Only need to look at Austria. Struggled post-election for centre and far-right to form a coalition, and they're now back at the beginning of the process again. So I guess the discussion is going to be, where's the balance lie? Is there a clear leader? Who's the additional piece of support they might need to form a government, and can they do it without the far right? And that's probably the big question. And I don't know where that's going to, where those discussions are going to begin, but we will see a new chancellor. The stuff with the Americans this week and going and meeting with the AfD and so on, Vance or whatever, just really poor form, to be honest. And just again, burning bridges with allies they just simply don't need to offend, but they seem to be making a habit of it at the moment.
And I think it's interesting, because the stuff that's going on with Ukraine and Russia surely might have some sort of impact on it. But I believe if I'm not mistaken, the conservative, so the Christian Democrats and also the Social Democrats, both are very supportive of Ukraine. And then you've got the far-right party and also the kind of left-wing populist mm-hmm. party who are against or who are effectively pro-Putin. Not even effectively, they're quite explicitly pro-Putin. So it will be very interesting. I think I'm not sure a lot of those opinion polls have kind of being able to read the sentiment, and it will be interesting to see what the sentiment will be after this week leading into it, because I've got to think that most of the, it could be an issue that could really swing support for those two major parties and squeeze some of the support that some of those smaller pro-Putin parties will have. So.
But I mean, the Greens are the next after the Social Democrats, right? And again, there might have been Social Democrat type Green coalition option, but the numbers won't be there for that. So it's really who the CDU are going to work with, because they are going to come out as the lead party, and whether they think they have to work with the AfD or they can go beyond them, which is I think what many people will hope that they do. And an issue like Ukraine could be the one which is the impetus to say, well, we need some sort of unusual centrist coalition because there is
Exactly.
this security threat not so far away, and this is an area where we're particularly aligned. Because if you look at other issues that might have divided those parties historically, maybe an approach to immigration, and obviously the criticism of Merkel now for the level of immigration during her tenure, the Trump and MAGA political ecosystem has moved all those conversations. So conversations are taking place in the UK and other European countries now around immigration, which the parties that are having those conversations about stricter immigration wouldn't have been having them 5 years ago. They would have been on a, whilst they might not have said we're in favour of open borders, they would have been making the economic argument for the need to have a managed process of immigration. And now we're all discussing that everyone seems to have lost control of their borders. America needs to shut the southern border with Mexico and stop the 2 grams of fentanyl that comes from Canada, to stop it. And within Europe, there's this discussion about sort of sealing the perimeter of Europe. And obviously, it was a big factor in Brexit and so on. But those conversations now seem to be pretty standard. It's not a divided issue between the left and the right, and most centrist parties in Europe, most of them seem to be on the same page. So I think it allows parties that might not previously have worked together to find a way to form a coalition. And it may well be what happens in Austria as well.
It's a very good point, and I think I mean we're in uncharted territory. So I think maybe it was unimaginable 5 years ago, but we might see a kind of locking out of these extremist kind of voices and some sort of coalition on the centre, which would be very interesting.
Oh, how quickly we've got rid of the Macron third way. Maybe its timing was now and it shouldn't have been when it did happen.
Honestly, 1 month into
Wow.
the Trump presidency, I don't know if I have the energy to do 47 more months of this, boys. I don't know about you guys.
Well, I'm already tired after this conversation. So I'm not sure I can keep this up for another. I'm not sure I can keep this up for another 4 years.
Well, no shortage of things to discuss this week. Gents, always a pleasure putting things simply with you both. See you next week.
Big then.
See you
Thank
later.
You.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.